KALW.
Race has been a hard issue for the United States forever, really. And sometimes it simmers and sometimes it boils, but it's never gone away.
President Biden's inaugural speech was focused on unity. But how? Today we talk to Professor John A. Powell of Cal's Othering and Belonging Institute.
You don't create zero-sum situations. One group wins, another group loses. And that's where the country is now.
Then we hear how some seniors are coping in this time of isolation.
I don't feel like myself. I feel like I'm in a nightmare, and then I'll wake up and it'll all be over.
And do you ever wonder why there's not a single billboard on most of Highway 280?
Visitors from all over the world wonder, why is all this land still so beautiful?
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Few people can argue that the country isn't heavily politically divided right now. We saw that with this last election. We've seen that over the past 4 years and beyond. Racial divides have deepened. People are polarized. And it feels like even having conversations with each other is a task that's so burdensome and can be emotionally loaded and just tiring. President Joe Biden dedicated his inaugural speech to unifying the country, finding common ground. But how? The Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley has been tackling these questions. How do we talk to each other when it feels like we're so divided? How do we start hearing one another and create a place where everyone feels welcome? John A. Powell heads the Institute. He's a longtime civil rights lawyer and racial justice leader. He's consulted with the Obama administration, and now he's consulting with the Biden administration. And he led a recent forum after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. I spoke to him right after that. You know, a lot of people are fearful of these times. A lot of people arming themselves. A lot of people black-sitting, which is black-sit. Kind of a black exodus from the U.S., people just moving from this country. You know, folks are afraid or tired. What do you do with that? I mean, what kind of conversations and dialogue can you have with somebody who's black and who says, yeah, we have a new president. Yeah, we're taking control of the House and the Senate, and Georgia's great, but I can't take this anymore.
Well, you know, you can't blame people. And, you know, I sort of, with tongue in cheek, but only partially, say that our health as a black man, that our health requires periodically we leave the United States to get away from this. But we can't really get away from it. At the height of the election season, I talked to friends in Australia and New Zealand, and there was all the talk about, well, you know, maybe I'll just move to New Zealand. And I'm one of those people who have the capacity to do that, both in terms of my resources and in my career. But our friends in New Zealand and Australia said, you know, you're welcome, but we actually need you to fix the United States, because if the United States is not fixed, the whole world suffers. You can't leave. You know, we're not going to Mars. A Tribe Called Quest already told us that. We're stuck here on Earth. And it doesn't mean we shouldn't be able to pull back, go places. And some people might just give up. It's not a real solution. We can't retreat from this thing. It's like climate change. It affects the entire climate. It affects the entire world. And now some places are going to be worse off than others, but there's no place that's going to be spared. And I traveled. I've lived in Africa, India, done work in Latin America. Race is there. And that's different than it is in the United States. And there are other expressions that are also important, like caste in India, lived in India. You know, so again, we may not want to constantly be on the negative end of that or even to deal with it, but it's not going to go away by itself. And there's no place to go. There's no mecca for us to go and just kick back. And the second thing, of course, is that I remember when David Duke was running, and I talked to my children about this, and they were afraid. They said, should we leave? He's part of the KKK, and he might become governor, and he might even become president. And at one point, I said to my children, I have a daughter and a son, you know, maybe you guys should leave, you know, but I'm going to stay here, because a lot of people can't leave. We have cousins, we have nieces and nephews, we have just the black community who, you know, if you can't pay your house note, you're not going to leave the country. And then I said, plus, it's not his country. You know, he doesn't, it's our country. And I said, but you guys can lead and I'll support that if you want to do that. And my daughter, who was like 12 at the time, said, I'm not leaving either. It's not his country. And so part of it is we may need to have retreat, but retreat is just a short period of time. Then we need to get back into it. That's the way I approach it.
How do we take this from academic conversations on fora to the street, to the suburb? The dialogue is so divisive right now. How do we really do what you're saying and create this change in the way people relate to one another in this time? Are you hopeful this can happen right now?
So it certainly could happen. I don't describe myself as an optimist or pessimist. I describe myself as a possibilist. And by that, I mean what we do matter. Things are possible. It doesn't mean we're going to necessarily get what we want. But if we don't engage, let's say, every shot you don't take, that's a shot you missed. And, you know, let me just come back to academic. A good academician, a good researcher is a weather person. So you look outside, it's sunny, and you say, you know, nice weather. A weather person says, you know, the barometric pressure is falling, and it's going to be a storm in 12 hours. It's like, well, how do you know?
Mm.
And so the reason I could say at the Democratic Convention that we weren't post-racial is white resentment was already there. You know, it wasn't explicit, but we could measure it. We could measure it increasing. And it's not just people. People are responding to things. So we need leadership as well from all sectors, from the religious sector, from community organizers, to corporate, to government. Instead, what we have is many leaders, certainly since the civil rights movement, using festering white resentment, festering fear, festering anxiety to stoke it up for their own benefit. You know, one of the Koch brothers recently said he made a mistake in terms of supporting the kind of polarization that existed in the country today. Now, it'd be interesting. Will he take his billions and start using it to actually bring people together? Murdoch, when he took over Fox News, the country wasn't so divided. But he actually turned the news. He weaponized information. He weaponized knowledge. So it's not just people. It is people. But it's also people. Some people have more power and influence than others. And they have used this, their power and influence, too often to divide people. We need to have some of those people use their power and influence to bring people together. And then we need to have everyday experiences. And we've seen it happen before. It can happen again. Will we do it? I don't know. But we are seeing more and more people. So if you think about the marches in response to the killing of George Floyd, that was the largest set of demonstrations in American history. And it was populated, led by the Black community, but populated by every community and populated by every part of the country, from police chiefs to corporate heads to church leaders, mm-hmm. not just in the United States, but all over the world. But we have to take that, we have to harness that energy and institutionalize it into our daily practice. So we really believe that Black Lives Matter. We really believe that police should not be able to kill Black people with impunity, regardless to what race you are, regardless to that may never happen in your community. How do you do that? And it's not simply rooting out the bad police. It's changing the structure and culture of policing and the country as a whole.
Where do you see Trumpism from now onward? What's happened? What's going to happen to it?
Well, I think I said earlier, you know, I'm part of a book on Trumpism and its discontent. And in that book, we talk about the seeds of Trumpism. The United States has always been at war with itself, particularly around race. And so, you know, literally, the Civil War, more people died in that war than all the wars combined in the United States. And the fight was, is the country a country that's open to all the people in a meaningful way? Is the religious question, am I my brother, not simply, am I my brother's keeper, but am I my brother's and sister's brother and sister? Can I recognize people of a different race, different ethnicity, different ability, different sexual orientation as part of me, as part of the family? And the United States has been ambivalent. We expand the we, then we contract it. when we expand it, some groups feel threatened, then we contract it. And that's what President Obama talks about when he talks about creating a more perfect union. That's what Lincoln's Gettysburg Address is about. Can we actually have a new birth of freedom? Can we correct some of those failures from the very beginning? And we have had some success, and then we've had some setbacks. So yes, I think, and it's now it's called upon us not just to do it at the national level, but to also think globally. The earth, the globe is smaller. Can we live? Can we share with Europe, with Latin America, with Africa, with China? And if we don't, it doesn't bode well for the future of human life on the planet. But I think we can.
You said, I think we can.
Yeah, we certainly can. Will we do it? And then we need to lift up examples. People are doing it all the time. People, you know, these there's these small expressions, sometimes bigger expressions. We need to, you know, they used to, you're in news, but, you know, they used to say, if it bleeds, it leads. So people like to hear bad stories. We have to change that. We have to give people examples, because if you can't imagine a better world, then you can't build a better world.
John A. Powell heads the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. You can hear my full conversation with him at KALW.org. That's also where you can find a recording of the forum they recently held. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Most of the people who've died from the coronavirus in the U.S. have been over the age of 65. Now, California's prioritizing getting the vaccine to seniors, but it could take 4 to 5 more months. In the meantime, the best way to stay safe is to stay isolated. But research has shown that loneliness can also be deadly. So what have people been doing lately to stay connected? In this story from our archives, Sarah Lai Sterland reports.
Did you know that the Big Bang happened about 13.5 billion years ago? And that the closest major galaxy is 2.5 million light years away from us? That's a big picture perspective that 80-year-old Donald Antanakis Matuzin pondered recently during a phone conversation with his friend, Sejal Doshi. They were playing a game where Donald slides his finger across the top of the pages of his encyclopedia as Sejal counts to 5. When she stops, his finger stops.
So at random, I'd pick a section, a page, and on that page, I would read. If we don't like that page, we could choose a page ahead and a page behind. But what we cannot do is just open up the book to any subject we might be interested in.
It's a game that Donald and Sejal played together in a single-room occupancy studio in San Francisco before the shelter-in-place order.
This forces us to learn something new, even about a subject we aren't inclined to be interested in.
And now they're playing the game over the phone. Donald's used to a really social life.
So at the senior center, I took a dancing class, specifically hula, and then the humanist group, in which I made 5 presentations, except for little brothers. They're all gone. I mean, that's a big minus in my life.
Little Brothers Friends of the Elderly is a nonprofit in San Francisco. There's plenty of research showing that loneliness was epidemic in the Western world even before the current coronavirus crisis.
Isolation and loneliness is something that kills people. If you are socially isolated, you have a 5 to 7 years of mortality greater than somebody who is socially active.
That's Little Brothers Executive Director Kathy Mihalik.
It lowers your immune system. And when you lower your immune system, you know, you can get different things wrong with you. You can have heart disease, diabetes, depression. The health effects is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And look at the national outcry when we found out that smoking can kill.
The abrupt changes in the past few weeks are hitting the elderly particularly hard, Kathy says, and that's why Little Brothers is working to keep up the phone calls to the 414 seniors it serves in San Francisco. But that number's just a tiny fraction of all the seniors living in the Bay Area. The California Department of Aging estimates that almost 2 million seniors live in the region. About 20% of them live alone.
So for many individuals who weren't necessarily anxious before, their world has been upended.
That's Dustin Harper, the Institute on Aging's chief strategy officer.
They're no longer able to go and perform the same daily routines that they've performed for a long time. That creates a real traumatic change in their lifestyle and can lead to heightened concerns.
He says calls to the Institute on Aging's friendship line for elders have doubled since the shelter-in-place order came down. Sally Saunders is an 80-year-old poet, and she's chafing under the order.
I'm very stressed. I don't feel like myself. I feel like I'm in a nightmare, and then I'll wake up in a minute and it'll all be over.
She lives in an assisted living facility and has her meals delivered to her. They're left in a bag on her door handle. Before the shutdown, she wrote a book of poems while vacationing on the Oregon coast with a friend. Now she's cooped up in her apartment, conducting her life through her computer.
I really like to go for nature walks. I can't do that. I like to travel. I can't do that. I can't see my friends. I can't hug my friends.
Governor Newsom announced that he was also trying to help by getting the state to partner with various nonprofits to make phone calls to seniors. The state also opened a COVID-19 telephone information line, and seniors can also call 211 for logistical help in their own neighborhoods. For his part, octogenarian Donald Antanakis Matuzin is doing the best he can. He's listening to public radio, texting with his friends, and working up the courage to go outside for a walk. He's also still chatting on the phone with his 32-year-old friend Sejal Doshi. Donald marvels that it was just a few weeks ago when they were sitting in his SRO listening to Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5. He was telling Sejal that this was a tune that his best friend whistled just before he died last fall. Donald misses sharing these stories in person.
It's like a dream now, just think. Sejal was here, and I was here, and we were listening to music here. What planet was that on? Beginning to feel like a dream.
It's a dream, or a nightmare, that he and others wish they could wake up from soon. For KALW in Los Gatos, I'm Sarah Lee Sterland.
That story was reported in April of last year. If you want information about how you can help support seniors, we've got it at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Since the beginning of the COVID lockdown, one thing my family's been doing is getting in the car and just driving. Discovering spots we haven't been to, driving to the ocean, to lakes, just driving. And there's one highway that's especially calm and scenic. And we noticed something. One of our listeners, David Scheer, did too. And he asked us,
why is Highway 101 plastered with billboards when Highway 280, just a little bit west, doesn't have any billboards?
As part of our crowdsourced journalism project, Hey Area, we sent reporter Christopher Agusa to find out.
This is a tale of two highways. I'm here in Palo Alto to check out both of them with David, our passionate question asker.
Billboards just annoy me. I just think they're ugly.
Highways 101 and 280 both snake their way up the peninsula, but they couldn't be more different.
An ad for ClearBank on the right and another high-tech ad for CIOs.
101 is dense and industrial and chock full of billboards.
Now they're really starting to pile up.
Yeah, another cannabis ad.
But David's least favorite?
The worst are the electronic billboards that are bright at night and change what they're showing.
David decides he's had enough and we switch over to 280. And suddenly, you can see trees.
And it's all beautiful and green.
To find out why these two freeways look so different, I talked with Lenny Roberts, who's a legislative advocate with an organization called Committee for Green Foothills. She's spent the last 50 years working to protect the Bay Area's open spaces. And she tells me that 280's beauty is the result of hard-won protections.
Well, 280 was designated as a scenic highway by the state of California after a lot of work in order to get it included. And billboards are not allowed on state scenic highways.
The California legislature passed the Scenic Highway Program into law in 1963. The state and counties worked together to prevent the development of anything that could make these routes look, well, less scenic.
Visitors from all over the world come to San Mateo. They'll fly to San Francisco Airport, come up to 280, and they wonder, why is all this land still so beautiful?
1,300 miles of scenic highway crisscross the state. Each stretch is marked by a sign emblazoned with a bright orange California poppy. But the scenic status isn't guaranteed forever. In 2016, the County of San Mateo put out a memo that hinted at studying locations for a few billboards along 280. That's when Lenny jumped into action.
I started asking questions and did not get a very satisfactory answer. Yes, they were going to consider 280.
She went to the press, which led to a flurry of news stories about the issue, and people freaked out. The county says it was a misunderstanding and that the memo was really referring to 101, but the backlash was loud and clear.
People would stop me in the grocery store and say, I saw you on TV. How dare they think about putting billboards on 280?
Having a scenic highway designation is one of the few clear lines of defense against billboards. Remember those electronic billboards that David hates so much? Well, since 2010, the number of those permitted by the state has nearly tripled. And for the first time ever, in 2013, a stretch of the I-10 near Palm Springs was officially removed from the Scenic Highway Program to allow for the construction of, you guessed it, a digital billboard.
We always need to stay vigilant and active to keep the protection we have and hopefully to gain more protections over time.
So I went back to David and shared everything I'd learned.
Do you think you'll be on the lookout for the poppy sign?
Now I can't ignore it. Now every time I see it, I'll know what it means.
On Highway 280, I'm Christopher Agusa for CrossCurrents.
That story was first reported in February of last year. And tune into CrossCurrents tomorrow at 5 to meet a clown who goes to hospitals and assisted living centers.
There was a patient there who never really spoke. Her decline in terms of dementia just really, really progressed.
In a story from our At Work series, we'll hear why clowning is essential tomorrow at 5. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Tommy Guerrero from San Francisco. His new album, Sunshine Radio, just came out. CrossCurrents team includes Scott Carroll, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Lisa Ramrika. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For CrossCurrents, I'm Hannah Baba.